Nelson's Renee Hollis is an author, photographer and organiser of collaborative projects for creative artists, and that varied life includes time she spent teaching in the Kalahari Desert in Botswana. We last talked to her a while back after she had written Keepers of History, New Zealand Centenarians Tell Their Stories, and Renee interviewed a whole lot of people over the age of 100 from every region of New Zealand. Quite a crowd of people are involved with this latest project of hers too, a book called Voices of World War II, New Zealanders Share Their Stories. Kia ora, Renee.
Good morning, Jim.
You've written an entire history of the war, the prelude, the call to arms, why men went and why they didn't, what women did, the training camps, formation of the Māori Battalion. It's got a large scope, Renee.
It has. It's a huge book to have put together, and it's taken me about 2 years.
How many people wrote it with you? Because you're telling, you have your own commentary, of course, but you're telling their stories verbatim as well.
I put the call out and basically asked if there were any untold stories, maybe stories that were just told in the family, and also if people had letters and diaries that they didn't know what to do with, and could I please borrow them? So I had a huge response, and there's over 100 families that ended up sending me material.
And you got all those fantastic photos with it, and that's a huge plus, isn't it?
That is, I wanted the book to be very visual. I didn't want the book to be a daunting task for people to pick up and read. I wanted it to be quite appealing to a wide range of people and ages. And I thought by having it very visual, people can flick through it and dip in and out. The images also tell stories as well.
There are hundreds of stories in here, and we'll probably just pick out a few of them. But the women, for example, didn't all stay home and knit and milk the cows that their men could not. And we'll get to famous examples of courage like Nancy Wake. But what the man shortage meant was that emancipation entered a new era. Women were put in charge of a lot. Police women, Renee, date from this time.
They do, yes. That was interesting reading about that. And that was a very new thing for New Zealand to have female policewomen. And there's also other women, say that are land girls too, that are going out suddenly in a remote farm and taking up all of these different jobs that they've never done before. And so I found it quite interesting. And also just looking at the everyday woman that was, say, married with a few children and their husband was overseas. And I just wondered what it was like for them. Did they have any support? Did they feel isolated? Was there camaraderie with the other woman? It was an interesting angle to look at it too.
And did you find or conclude that the sorority, that support you talk about, was alive and well?
It seems to be from what I've read. They said that they'd get together and, you know, pack cakes and parcels, and it was a good chance to have a bit of a gossip and catch up. And most of those women were in the similar situations, so I suppose they could relate and support each other.
There was no shortage of conspiracy theories. The Germans were said to have a fort in the Waitakere just outside Auckland. Two policemen in a Hillman Hunter motor car drove out there armed with handguns to check things out. You can imagine, well, you tell us about the rumours running riot through society at the time early in the war.
One of the interesting quotes that I found was that people said that the war would be over by Christmas. And I thought, wow, really? People actually thought that? And also the fear that a lot of New Zealanders had of the Japanese invading, that they had this theory that they were very close.
Japanese reconnaissance aircraft over Auckland and Wellington. I knew about the Wellington one. You can imagine how everyone, as you surmise, was waiting for the invasion. That was a very real prospect.
It was, and I actually spoke to a lady who was living down the Marlborough Sounds as a young child during World War II, and she talked about the real fear in their families and the fact that they had food and blankets and supplies hidden in caves around the farm that they could go and hide in when the Japanese arrived.
Yeah, the Battle of the Coral Sea, I think, put paid to all those expansionary plans. When Heather Firth of Tauranga went out on a fishing boat one day to Mare Island off the Bay of Plenty in 1942, she was quite surprised to see a Japanese submarine and the crew having a swim and enjoying the beach. Now, you get these stories told to you in the book, not necessarily always confirmed, and I mean, maybe not always true, but we know there was a Japanese submarine cruising Cook Strait, and there was a chilling sounding account from two young girls in the Marlborough Sounds, wasn't there?
There was. This was a story that I was told years before I started this project, and it really got me thinking about untold stories. The story I was told, sorry, was that there were two young girls on a farm in the Marlborough Sounds. I think they were maybe about 10 and 8 at the time. And they were told by their parents that if the Japanese were on their land, that they were to take these cyanide tablets. And one evening, their parents were not on the farm, and they were just sort of keeping guard. It was a full moon, and they saw Japanese coming onto their farm. And so they sort of went to go for their cyanide tablets, and then realized, sort of watched a little bit, and realized that the Japanese were just getting some water and then returning. And I thought, wow, that was an amazing story. And I talked to a sister of the two girls. She wouldn't deny or confirm the story, but I just thought, wow, there must be lots of other untold stories or stories that are just told in families that I'm not aware of.
Even if that was apocryphal, it makes a great story, doesn't it? That's the thing.
It does, yes.
Children at school digging air raid trenches. There were air raid shelters. You've got photos of that. At Titirangi School in Auckland, they excavated a tunnel in the cliff and even created bends in it to stop the bomb blasts penetrating the interior. So that gives us an extra idea of the intensity of mood at the time, doesn't it?
It does, and also children learning to identify a Japanese aircraft at school. And I read an interesting quote down in Invercargill, and it said, this is a memory of this little boy, and he said, at school every morning we lined up on the tennis court and New Zealand flag was raised to the top of the flagpole and the speaker would be brought out and hung on the wall and the Invercargill march would be played. We would march around the tennis court in our classes and stopped and saluted the flag. This happened every morning, weather permitting. But that was interesting too.
It was a different time in New Zealand, wasn't it? Different country almost. It's interesting how many accounts of the war in here, thanks to your collaborators, are from ordinary soldiers who might not have won medals, but they had amazing adventures. And one of them is Captain John Richardson, captured by the Italians and badly injured after his truck was blown up by a German tank. And from then on, things got steadily worse for John.
Yes, the story about John was a remarkable one and something that played out like a movie, really. And so, yes, he was badly injured and he became a POW in 1941, the end of 1941, and he was in Bari Hospital in Italy. And the quote here by him says, Bari Hospital was an unrelenting nightmare, but for Hank the Yank, he was a remarkable character. I learned that he was an Italian gangster who had been living in Brooklyn, New York, and had been deported back to Italy from America. And he cared for John and fed him and washed him and helped get rid of his lice and protect him from drunk doctors and all sorts. And then when he was well enough, he was moved to Campo 82 and ended up helping the Italian colonel run the POW camp there with 3,000 men in it.
A drunken doctor tried to amputate his leg. John smashed him over the head with a bedpan to prevent this occurring, and things got very dangerous with the guards. Very dangerous indeed. He was assaulted in terrible fashion. And Hank the Yank, that Italian gangster you mentioned who seemed to have a special status, he took John under his wing and basically saved his life, didn't he?
He did, yes.
There are some pretty spectacular stories in your book. I didn't know that men from the Māori Battalion, and there's quite a lot about the Māori Battalion in your book, some of those men were selected to train in the mountains of Lebanon in case that kind of warfare, ski warfare, was required, but it never was. So there were some pleasant assignments.
Yeah.
We know about Nancy Wake, the White Mouse, who fought with the resistance in France and even led men in fighting against the Germans. But you have also found Phyllis Latour, a.k.a. Pippa Doyle, codename Genevieve. Tell us about her.
So, yes, so Pippa Doyle is a person that I would love to interview and write a book about, but she is very reluctant to share any of her secrets or any of her stories. And she trained with Nancy Wake, so she was in the UK Special Operations Executive during World War II, but her family didn't even know that she was a spy until about the year 2000 when they discovered it, you know, reading about their mum online on the internet. So she signed the Secrecy Act with Churchill, and she's taking all of her stories to the grave. But yeah, during the war, about 500 SOE agents were sent to France, and one in five never returned. So it was very high risk, and she's been living in Auckland for a long time. So yeah.
She posed as a teenage girl in occupied France. She sent radio messages to London with intelligence that guided in the planes on bombing raids, and she pedalled around on a bicycle carrying knitting, you tell us, with radio codes pricked into pieces of silk. Gosh, what a life.
Yes.
What
amazing.
Daring. Amazing.
Yes.
Well, all the battles are here, what life was like day to day, not just in the trenches, all the fun they had along with the terror, what the women did at home, photos of it all. Great idea to get the input from all these Kiwi families, Renee, in the end.
Yes, well, I wasn't sure what kind of response I would get, and I was pleasantly surprised when people were sending me material and diaries and censored letters with words cut out, and also digital diaries that they'd typed up. But I thought this was going to be a really interesting way for people to learn about our social history. It's all in first person, and you can almost hear each person talking as you read the quotes. So yeah. I'm really happy with it.
My last question was going to be, what did you learn most in writing this book? I suppose for you as well as us, it's how many stories have never been told but are in here.
I think so, and I'm sure that there's more stories as well that haven't been told. Yeah, I think a lot of the families are very proud that, you know, that the text has been written down or images have been put into a book, but I'm sure there's other stories out there too.
Voices of World War II, New Zealanders share their stories. Renee Hollis, thank you very much for joining us. Well done on the book.
Thank you so much.